Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Overcoming Hate Through Dialogue, Confronting Prejudice, Racism, and Bigotry with Conversation and Coffee by Özlem Çekiç, narrated by Siri Scott. Chapter 1. Why Do They Hate You? Learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Albert Einstein. As a Turkish immigrant, born to Kurdish parents, I became one of the first ethnic minority women to win a seat in the Danish parliament in 2007. It was also the year I began receiving hate mail. It's amazing how quickly I got used to finding my inbox full of hate. "What's a packy like you doing in our parliament?" they'd write. "You don't belong here." Or simply, "Terrorist." Delete, delete, delete. I never even considered replying. We had absolutely nothing in common. They didn't understand me, and I didn't understand them. As far as I was concerned, engaging with anyone so entrenched in their own ignorance would have been a complete waste of time and effort. Then, one day, my colleague suggested I should save those messages. "If nothing else," she said, "they'll be useful to the police when something happens to you." I noted that she said when something happens, not if. Though I didn't really believe it would come to that, I took her advice and started saving every email that arrived. For a while, they were simply filed and forgotten. That is, until things took a more worrying turn. In 2008, I returned from my summer vacation to find a card in my mailbox. It was decorated with the Danish flag, and since, in Denmark, we use the flag to mark any festive occasion, my first thought was that it must be a party invitation. But inside was something rather different. "Return tickets home. Go back to your terrorist brothers." These greetings had come from the Danish Association, an organization with deep roots in Denmark's extreme right. That they knew my address was frightening enough, but when I examined the envelope, I saw, to my horror, that there was no stamp. It hadn't arrived by post. It had been delivered by hand. In my mind, that changed everything. The reassuring distance I thought I'd established between me and my abusers, between my kids and my abusers, had suddenly evaporated. Whoever these people were, they were too close for comfort now. Immediately, I took steps to remove my address from public records. I made sure that the names of my children's daycare and schools were not publicly available either. But, at the same time, I knew that the more involved I became in parliamentary debates, the more I would attract this kind of attention, and the steadier the stream of threats and abuse would become. These threats ranged from the vague, "We know where you live," to the terrifyingly specific, "The day you become a minister, we will cut your throat." I received them. I read them. I passed them all on to the police. This became my new normal. But in the spring of 2010, a neo-Nazi began to harass me. I couldn't dismiss his actions as an idle threat to my safety. This was a man who had previously attacked Muslim women on the street. For more than 8 months, he called me day and night, sometimes upward of 40 times a day. I had become his obsession. One day, while I visited the zoo with my kids, my phone rang. I ignored it, certain it was him. We had just arrived and had only gotten as far as the lion's den. I was determined not to allow him to ruin our day. But when I saw his text, I panicked. Convinced that he was at the zoo and that he was watching us, we got out of there fast. When we were back at home, my son, Furkan, asked, "Mom, why does he hate you so much when he doesn't even know you?" I told him, "Some people are just stupid." At the time, I thought that was a pretty clever answer. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys, that's all you need to know. But how I wish it were that simple. The truth was, this man had upended my life. He was the reason I parked my car in a different spot every night when I came home, the reason I constantly looked over my shoulder in the street, the reason I could no longer enjoy a day out with my children. Several weeks after the incident at the zoo, I confided in my photographer friend, Jakob Holt. Jakob had documented racism in the United States in his book, American Pictures, so I was sure he was the right shoulder to cry on. Tearfully, I told him my fears and about the fury I felt over the restrictions this neo-Nazi idiot's behavior had created in my daily life. I waited for words of comfort and reassurance. Instead, his response knocked me sideways. "You're just as judgmental of people like them as they are of people like you," he said. I was stunned. "I'm no racist. Is that what he was accusing me of?" Sure, if I were to be totally honest, there had been times in my life when I had hated other people. Certain groups who, I knew, hated me right back. But I had grown into an open-minded, liberal human being, right? I'd put it all behind me. Hadn't I? "How many of your friends and family vote for right-wing parties?" he asked. "Do you even talk to people who do?" I had to admit it. None. And no. In fact, for a long time, this had been a source of pride for me. I often boasted to my friends that I never shook hands with MPs from the alt-right Danish People's Party. I was proud of the distance I had created between myself and them. I never questioned whether I was right in doing so, until Jakob suggested, "Go out and meet them. Your son deserves a better answer." "Meet them? They'd kill me," I said. "They don't kill MPs," Jakob said, before adding with a wry smile, "In any case, if they do, you'll be a martyr. Win-win." I can't say that I found the prospect of martyrdom very reassuring at that point, but Jakob had planted the seed of an idea. So when, in the autumn of that year, the police tracked down the man who had been hounding me, I took a deep breath and suggested a mediation meeting. He refused, but I wasn't giving up. It was clear to me that ignoring hate didn't simply make it disappear. I had to understand it better. I had to know why so many people hate Danish Muslims like me. And the obvious place to start was my inbox. There were, by then, hundreds of emails. Several had come from the same handful of senders. Most began by addressing me as Paki, terrorist, Muslim rat, or whore. When it comes to insults, the Danish language is wonderfully diverse. I decided to contact a few of the people who'd emailed me. My aim was not so much to get to know them, as Jakob had suggested, as it was to convert them to righteousness. I'm not sure what sort of miracle I imagined would occur when my haters finally came face to face with a Muslim. Perhaps I hoped that, by confronting them with their own prejudices, I could somehow cure them of making these baseless generalizations about us. I wanted to be a paragon of virtue, living proof that there are Muslims who work, abide by the law, and support democracy. Today, I can see this as delusional, but back then, at the start of all this, I saw myself as a savior on a mission. Armed with a sense of justice, I sat down to type, and before I knew it, I was inviting myself for a visit. And that's how the coffee dialogues began, and how, since the winter of 2010, I have sought out coffee and conversation with people I know harbor hatred toward me and people like me. What began with that email has led to hundreds of encounters. Each one is another step toward understanding prejudice, my own as well as theirs. Over time, I've given up on being a savior. I've learned not to try to convince people of anything, or to attempt to make them good. Instead, I just listen and try to discover where their feelings of impotence, fear, and hatred originate. I've discovered that no matter how abusive a person may be, they still serve cake with their coffee. And every time I begin a dialogue with coffee and cake on the table, I'm reminded of how right Jakob was when he told me I needed to confront my own racism. The first of these meetings was with Ingolf, and I will never forget it. His email was brimming with bile. "All you care about is taking whatever you can for yourself and your kind," he wrote. In my imagination, Ingolf was the embodiment of hatred, hard, nasty, and twisted. Before we met, I imagined the moment I would shake his hand with its long, dirty fingernails and enter his pigsty of a home. So, imagine my disappointment when he opened his door and revealed himself to be a perfectly respectable-looking gentleman. He served coffee in the same coffee set that my parents have at home. As expected, our conversation revealed that we disagreed on many things. Ingolf's views on Danish Muslims were extreme. Among other things, he had helped found Radio Holger, a radio station that caters to a neo-Nazi audience. But we also had a lot in common. We shared the same type of working-class background, and even some of the same prejudices. I remember Ingolf telling me how angry he got whenever a raghead bus driver stopped 10 meters away from where he was waiting at the bus stop. Immediately, I recognized that feeling. I told him that when I was younger, if a bus didn't stop for me, I was sure that the driver was a racist. It struck me then that what we believe to be conscious acts of malice are often just innocent mistakes. It was a shock to me that Ingolf could possibly feel as discriminated against as I did. But he did. Listening to him, I had to confront my own judgments. He was neither evil nor stupid. He was angry. My meeting with him was the first of many meetings with racists, which turned into a reevaluation of my own preconceptions, interpretations, and generalizations. I have been surprised by how much I have found in common with the people I have visited, and the extent of my own racist prejudice. I use the word racist in a broad sense. To me, a racist is someone with hateful prejudice against another demographic group, characterized by their race, religion, ethnicity, sexuality, gender, or age. In that sense, I know I have been a racist. As a child, I hated Jews. I never voiced the feeling, but when I saw pictures of murdered Palestinian children, I hated Jews, all Jews. Later, as a teenager, I was spat on in the street for wearing the hijab. In those moments, whenever I was on the receiving end of the hatred that one Dane felt toward all Muslims, I responded in kind and began hating all Danes, believing them to be uniformly racist. In the late 1990s, when the conflict between the Turks and the Kurds intensified, as an assimilated Kurd, ashamed by my inability to speak Kurdish, I was filled with loathing for the nationalist Turks. But meeting them, talking to them, and getting to know them personally helped this hatred melt away. I may still disagree with some of them politically, but the hatred is gone. I confess that there was still one group for whom my hatred never waned, even as an adult. Racists. Those who accused me and my family of being parasites, criminals, and fundamentalists. Those who thought that, even though my children were born at the National Hospital and grew up in Denmark, they would never be Danes. For many years, I saw myself as superior to them because I didn't judge them based on their religion, ethnicity, sexuality, gender, or age. I was convinced that I was an open-minded person who treated everyone as an equal. That is, until I reached out to some racists, sought to understand them, and in doing so, grew wiser about them, about myself, and most of all, about the things we share. Building Bridges. This book tries to give my son's question, "Why do people hate people they don't know?" a more qualified answer than the one I offered him after our trip to the zoo. This book will take you with me into meetings with people who hate, fear, or feel threatened by other population groups, people whom many would shun, people whose arguments are ignored because they are difficult to accommodate and painful to countenance. And it asks, is it possible to build a bridge over hate? At all my coffee dialogues, there is one particular argument that emerges repeatedly, regardless of whether I am talking to a humanist or a racist. It is that someone else is always to blame for the divisiveness and discord, and that it is, therefore, their duty to rectify it. Parliament must do something. Local government must do something. Schools must do something. Your neighbor must do something. Only rarely do people say that they themselves must do something. But I feel that each and every one of us has to do something to support democracy. I believe we do this best by insisting on dialogue where there is disagreement, and history has shown that to be an effective means of building a better future. Over 100 years ago, women did not have the right to vote. Only 44 years ago, abortion was illegal in Denmark. Only 36 years ago, many Danes believed that homosexuality was a disease. And it was only 20 years ago that corporal punishment of children became illegal. Things have changed because there were people who insisted that attitudes and legislation could be altered through debate. But the road to understanding is not paved by ignoring attitudes we dislike or by silencing others' points of view. The distances between people seem to have grown wider. Extremists, both to the right and to the left, are increasingly influential. Abusive language is rampant on social media, and people readily label one another racists, traitors, or worse. Unfortunately, I get the impression that politicians exacerbate this situation all too often, with both wings competing to demonize their opponents. Extremism must be opposed. But the solution isn't to meet hatred with more hatred, or to imitate the hate speech of others. In order to understand the origins of other people's feelings of hopelessness, frustration, and sometimes seething hatred, we must listen to one another. In this book, I invite you to join me as I visit people who loathe entire segments of the population. You'll meet Kim, a right-wing extremist who lives in an allotment garden house on the island of Funen, and who, if he only had a gun, would take delight in killing the Muslims outside the local mosque. You'll meet Muslim adolescents with guns, a Nuremberg's Red Square, whose contempt for Danish society runs deep. I'll take you into the Hizb-e Tahrir Mosque, where the imam preaches against democracy and homosexuality. And along the way, I will share my own history of hatred for Jews, Turks, Danes, and racists. Finally, a small plea. Some of the people you will encounter and some of the discussions you will hear in this book will put your fundamental values to the test. But I hope you will stay with me, even when you find it hard to bear. Chapter 2. How I Hated the Danes. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People must learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love, for love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. Nelson Mandela. Hatred of other ethnic groups is often ignited by personal experience. My own hatred of ethnic Danes began when I was 12 years old. It was summertime, and I had gone to town, wearing jeans and a hijab. Far from being a symbol of my oppression, as many non-Muslims are quick to assume, the hijab was, to me, a symbol of youthful rebellion. My parents are devout, but when I suddenly started covering my hair with a hijab, my mother couldn't understand why. She wears a hijab herself and has been on pilgrimages, but if you ask her why she does it, she will simply say that it's part of her culture. In the Vesterbro district of Copenhagen, my upbringing was rather different from hers, culturally speaking. None of my friends wore the hijab, which I suspect is why she could make no sense of my decision. But the truth was, I needed to shift people's focus away from my manner of speech. I had recently returned to Denmark after a 2-year stay in Turkey and wanted my classmates to fixate on something other than the faults in my Danish grammar and pronunciation. I found the fact that the hijab irritated my parents so much to be an amusing secondary benefit. When my father attended a parents' meeting, my teacher gave him a long lecture about how he shouldn't force me to wear it. Since my father's Danish was not very good, I was asked to interpret. But he understood well enough to scold me all the way home for giving the impression he had forced me into covering up. I just thought it was funny. But when the other girls at school decided they thought it was cool to wear the hijab, I stopped wearing mine. Now that I was no longer the mysterious hijab girl, it had stopped being fun. But during the 2 years I wore it, I learned how many people see it as a provocation. The experience came at a cost. At age 12, as I walked alone into town, I saw a young man walking toward me. I remember he was tall, slim, and dressed in black. As we made eye contact, I saw that he was moving his mouth in an odd way. I wondered if he might speak. Then, just as we were about to pass one another, he lunged and spat at me. I froze. I couldn't even turn my head to say something because there, hanging on the edge of my hijab, was a giant gob of spit threatening to swing toward my face. So I stood there, in the street, with my head bowed, hoping that gravity would eventually deal with the worst of it. With no tissues to hand, I waited and waited, and the gob of spit grew longer and longer, but stubbornly refused to drop to the ground. As I stood there, people walked past me as if I were invisible. I could have taken the hijab off, but I didn't even contemplate it. I knew the hijab was the reason he'd spat at me in the first place. Removing it would mean capitulation, defeat. I did, however, have to accept that the gob of spit was not going to fall of its own accord, so I flicked it off with my hand. As soon as I touched it, my lunch rose up in my throat, my mouth filled with vomit. I threw up, then continued to retch for several minutes in the street. Strangely, it brought some kind of relief to purge myself like that. Before I turned around and began my walk back home, I took a bottle of water from my bag and washed my hands and mouth, then poured the rest over my hijab. For several years, I suppressed my memories of that day. The humiliation and degradation I felt looking back was too much to bear. Yet, in the moment, I remember feeling almost nothing. No anger, no vulnerability, no frustration. Nothing except terrible nausea. I guess I took my numbness as proof that he hadn't hurt me. I believed I was unaffected. But not long after, when an elderly man tried to pull off my hijab as I crossed the road at a crosswalk, I reacted with such fury that I don't doubt I had been bottling up my true feelings about the attack. As I walked, again alone, across the intersection, I felt him take hold of my hijab from behind and yank me backward. I was about to fall on my back when he pulled me upright again. Yelling and screaming at him, I stomped onto the traffic island. People must have thought I was having a hysterical fit, and began screaming at him, "Racist! Racist! Racist! Danish racist!" Those were the words that flew out of my mouth, and from that moment on, I saw Danes differently. I began to notice all their small, everyday microaggressions. The more racist encounters I experienced, the more I became convinced that all Danes were racists. In hindsight, I realized that some incidents reflected my own prejudices more than anyone else's. Like when some Danish guy at the supermarket checkout snapped at my mother for trying to buy 20 packs of sale price butter when there was a 5 packs per customer limit. Sure thing, I thought. Clearly, he was racist too. But woven between incidents I perceived as racist were examples of genuine discrimination, like when my mom was standing in a phone booth calling her sister in Turkey, and a man in line screamed, "Speak Danish, damn it!" right in her face. They'd never met before, yet he still felt he had the right to yell at her and even dictate the language she should speak. The number of racists surrounding me grew. I started seeing them everywhere, and at one point, I found it almost impossible to distinguish a tolerant Dane from a racist Dane. It became so difficult that I conflated one with the other. Both were my enemies, and so it was that I began to hate the Danes. I hated them because they were xenophobic and full of generalizations. I hated them because they hated me, my family, and all Muslims. But I also hated them because they wanted to make us change. There was no satisfying them, ever. There was always something they felt they needed to criticize. Take Ramadan. I have always fasted during Ramadan and love the tranquility and contemplation that come with it. For me, Ramadan is the coziest, most comforting time of the year, and I look forward to it like a child anticipating Christmas. But Ramadan isn't Christmas, and the teachers at my school rarely said anything positive about it. Instead, they asked a lot of critical questions like, "Isn't it tough? Isn't it very unhealthy? Do your parents force you to fast? And how can you stand it?" And when the month of Ramadan ended with a 3-day feast, my teachers seldom asked what gifts I'd received or complimented me on my new clothes. At school, we had to spend hours talking about Christmas, but Eid was sidelined. That's because they're racists, we Muslim students agreed at break time. If we were Christians...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?